Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and this is stuff your doctor should know. Indeed, your doctor should know these things, especially today, this particular guest who I've had before. And just as a fact that you should know, out of all the 240 shows that I have done over the past 7 years, this person, his episodes, I have listened to more than any other guest that I've ever had, because I just learn so much every time I re-listen, and I hear things that I missed previously over and over. And it's just, he's a wealth of knowledge. He's just so good at digging up the facts. And, you know, I feel like he's the bridge between people like myself. I'm just a person, you know, who was very sick, who got better because of alternative medicine and because of taking my health into my own hands. And, you know, and I acquired knowledge. I did go to school for nutrition, but I acquired knowledge, most of my knowledge, through mentors like this person. And, you know, so I need help when I hear clinical studies. I need help reading journals, not all the time, but, and he is that person. You know, he's someone who can bridge the gap between the layman, you know, those of us who just are working all the time and, you know, are busy. Some of you have families, and it's hard. It's hard to open up a study from The Lancet and have time to sit there and interpret, read through it, and then interpret it, and then share it. It's hard. And so we need people like this, you know, to come in and be that bridge. And I love him for that. So yeah, Georgi Dinkov is here with me again today. And we just jump right into it. And I want to warn those of you who are who don't like politics, or who do and just don't like our politics, this might be hard for you to listen to, because we talk a lot about it. And while I'm talking about it, I'm thinking, you know, when we're talking, I was thinking to myself, maybe I shouldn't air this. Maybe I should just make it a shorter show. But then he made this correlation. You know, he said, you know, our outlook, he says it in his own way, our outlook on the world, the way we perceive things that are going on around us, the way we handle political events, the way we handle and look at geopolitics, the way we deal with our local politics, the way we deal with everything, our health matters. It matters. The way you view life is based on how healthy you are, truly. And it makes sense. Look around. Look how sick everyone is. We might be living longer, but we're living longer with a heck of a lot more disease. You know, we have a lot more imbalances. We're dealing with a lot of non-communicable diseases. It's crazy. And our youth are sicker than ever. And we're going out into the world as sick individuals, or as out of balanced individuals. And we're looking at an event, and we're trying to have a rational, conscious, good decision about it, or evaluate it in a healthy way. And how can we? How can you when you're not healthy? You know, and I'm not accusing anyone, and I'm not saying that I am healthy or that I'm not healthy. I think we probably vacillate, some of us, between having very stressed out, high cortisol, you taking things very personally and getting very upset, to sometimes when you're feeling really balanced and you look at an election or something, and you're able to handle that and not be so stressed out, or you're able to watch some news and not freak out. Anyway, he makes a very good point. They're not separate. They're part of the same thing. And let's not forget who attacked our medical freedoms over the last 2 years and actually made health and medical decisions a political matter. That wasn't us, right? Anyway, so listen up, take some notes. I'll catch you on the backside. You know, it seems like we're in a World War III that started as...
We already are.
Yeah.
Just hasn't gone kinetic yet.
Yeah.
We are already in World War III.
And it started kind of with the information war, right? Mm-hmm. And all this information and access to information, and we're all in it to some degree. But then it's of course turned into actual boots on the ground now and all these things. But the thing that bothers me the most is not like, I get that they're trying to shut us down here. I get that they're trying to destroy this republic and change the way America is. And but what's really upsets me, and I wanted to ask you this, is like, isn't it weird that so many people are buying into that it's a good thing? Like, that's what worries me more than anything.
I think they call it the horizontal totalitarianism. Back in the day, the countries practiced vertical. In other words, the government would oppress you. But now they've managed to get basically 2/3 of the population to get them on board. And the reason I think is basically, I don't know if you maintain contacts with these people. I used to work with them. I mean, I no longer do. I would say the majority of the population is basically already on a universal basic income. I mean, the powers that be call these people that are actually their allies, they call them the useless eaters, right? It's because these people don't really do anything meaningful on their jobs. These jobs can be tomorrow, they can disappear, and we probably won't even notice, you know? Like the vast majority of these people simply move numbers from one spreadsheet into another. And I don't mean to demean their labor. I mean, I'm sure that they actually spend the time doing that. But it's stuff that's basically gotten to the point where, you know, a significant. Have you seen the movie Office Space?
No.
Well, it's a classic in about the meaninglessness of corporate work, and it was done. That movie was in 1999. I'll just look it up. Office Space. It's a very famous one. And basically, they have this famous scene where it's a software company, and most people there, especially the protagonists, their jobs are pointless. So they bring in these two consultants, they're management consultants, to kind of straighten things out, which really means fire most of the people, right? And then they sit with a protagonist and basically say, "What do you actually do in this company, Mr. whatever his name was?" And he says, "Actually, not much. I come in the morning. I stare for 2 hours at the wall in my cubicle. Then I go to a Monday morning meeting where we basically I continue staring aimlessly at the wall. Then we go back, and I for half an hour I pretend that I'm actually doing something on the computer, but I'm really what I'm doing is using my keyboard as a piano. And then we go to lunch, and then we go back, and then we go through the TPS reports, which is this term that they use, like I think transaction processing or something. But he's like, but they're completely meaningless. He's like, it's about transactions that already happened. There's nothing for us to review. And then I go back to like my desk, and and this is basically what life has become for at least 2/3 of the population, the Western population. We became a service level economy, service economies, right? Instead of producing things, we now produce like imaginary things, right? It's just services. And for the vast majority of office workers in such service economies, basically, their job is the country doesn't depend on it, you know. Financial instruments, I don't know. So I guess software could be useful to a degree, but I think we've long passed the saturation point where software is now kind of like has a negative marginal rate of return. Like just the more software we include into our lives, the worse we become, right? The more controlled, but also the less effective, less efficient. We're more monitored, right? And basically, I think that's what kind of what happened is like, even though there's a lot of talk about universal basic income, how you can get everybody to receive like a sufficient amount of money to survive, right? And they don't have to work because everything is automated now, right? We can survive without workers. That's actually true for 2/3 of the population and has been true for a while. So these people, if tomorrow you basically like what we like the people who want to be independent, what we offer them doesn't work for them. They cannot live in our world. Tomorrow, these people have to go and survive on the street. God forbid, have to like do hard physical labor or like, I don't know, move things around. Like you said, you haul a lot of stuff with your truck. That scares them. That petrifies them. The majority of them are at least one psychotropic drug. I mean, now I don't know if you saw my posts. Basically, there's an epidemic of cancer in the young. Now, basically, young age is a factor, risk factor for stroke. Used to be old age is a risk factor for stroke. Now the stroke, the study was really astounding. The stroke rates in the old are dropping, but they're rising in the young. So basically now the first thing the doctor's going to ask you when you go to the doctor, a new doctor is like, how old are you? And if you say I'm under 30, oh my God, let's check you for cancer. Let's check you for stroke. Let's check you for all these things that used to be old man disease. So these people basically, which is 2/3 of the population, more or less, they cannot live, they cannot survive in the normal world. They're entirely dependent on the government. Now, and basically, if the government says, look, we'll feed you, we'll take care of you, but you have to do as we say, they're saying, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am. And
It's
that's my
for the
take.
greater good. I mean, it kind of was set up that way. And we look, when you look back on COVID and everything, you're like, oh my God, that was all part of it, because getting those stimulus checks, people got really used to it. And now that that's
Course.
over, there's so many people, like my mom was saying in Albuquerque, like it's hard to get servers, it's hard to get bartenders, it's hard to get people to do like regular menial jobs.
They don't want to go back to that to doing that work. I mean, in their defense, I see it basically like really the solution is not to get to put them on UBI. The solution is to bring back the outsourced jobs, but it's going to take a decade at least if it's done in earnest, right? And what are these people doing in the meantime? Life will not be very easy for them, right? So, but what the powers that be say are basically saying, look, outsourcing is kind of irreversible. They're not going to try. They're basically saying like we like the cheaper labor over there. So now we have this mass of people that is in the Western countries that is basically useless. You know, they call them the useless eaters. So what do we do? I mean, if these people revolt, I think you'll see basically overnight governments toppled everywhere. But these people are basically kept in control by giving them stuff mostly for free, you know, at the expense of us. By printing money, they're robbing me and you, the hard workers and savers, and transferring that wealth, quote unquote, to the vagrants, right? It's really, it's basically, it's a hidden tax. That's what inflation really is.
Well, what do you think about Brazil right now? Because I'm shocked
Surely.
that there's so much uprising. Like here, I thought for sure that when the trucker convoy happened and then it kind of America got involved, I thought for sure this would be amazing. And I thought all the trucks would be stopped on all the freeways of the United States and everybody would just say, no, we're not going to play this game anymore. We're in control. You guys work for us and just stop. And
I
then
think that kind of happened actually. That's probably the reasons we haven't. Have you seen what happened in Canada? They're now proposing a new law to euthanize children, minor children, without parental consent. So just the very fact we're discussing this as a civilized society, and it's probably, I mean, I don't know if they're going to propose it here, but it's already a fact in the European Union, especially Belgium, Netherlands, and I think to a degree France as well. That basically now you can get euthanized by your own volition in one of these countries without having a terminal incurable disease. Used to be only in those cases, right? Now they've relaxed basically the requirements that you don't have to have an incurable disease. All you have to do as an adult in these countries go to the doctor and say, I just kind of don't feel like living anymore. Like I'm depressed, or like my life is not going well, or I kind of generally feel hopeless, or in general, I just don't find joy in living anymore. That is sufficient for over there to basically make you eligible for assisted suicide. And if that wasn't enough, now Canada is proposing a law. The very fact that this is proposed and it's actually being debated seriously, that basically minor children at the age of, let's say, 5 or 6 can tomorrow decide, and guess who will help them decide? The very people who will be charged with euthanizing them. These young children can decide on their own if they want to be euthanized or not. I think this, to me, this is the point of no return.
I
Once
can't
you come for
even.
my children, yeah, once whoever it is comes for my children, then the gloves will come off.
So
So
this
yeah.
is Canada where
Canada.
you can't even order a blood lab for yourself. You can't even, we have a hard time getting progesterone over there, and they're going to
Precisely.
let you. I mean, the upside downness that's happening, right? The inside, the inversion of everything and the
The perversion,
perversity.
they came up with the concept mature minor. Have you? I mean, just the contradiction of terms right there. A mature minor, it's actually now a legal term in Canada and several countries of the European Union. If a psychologist or psychiatrist or whatnot and a doctor basically get together in a room with the child without the parent being present, right? And they evaluate the child and they declare this child mature as an adult, capable of making life and death decisions. But guess what? Isn't this the biggest conflict of interest? Why would the people basically that are charged with will be charged, or at least are on the same side of the people who will be euthanizing the child? Why are those people allowed to make the decision whether this child? I mean, it's just absurd
It's
that we've
absurd.
gotten to the point where we're basically debating, and it's just the term that they came up with to me is already it's scary. I mean, to them it just doesn't even ring a bell. A mature minor. The whole point of minor is that they're immature, right? That's what we call them, minors. If they weren't immature, they wouldn't be minors. But no, they came up with mature minor, and now this is a legal term in Canada and several EU countries, and it's necessary as a legal framework in order to allow this child to, quote unquote, decide that he wants to end his or her life.
What do you think? Where does that, where is the law? I mean, the logic of mature minor is insane, but where is the, like, why would you want to even do that? Do they see, are they seeing something that was really disturbing to them and these children where they're like, we have so many depressed, like, how do you arrive at the place to say, let's talk with this child about terminating his life? How do you even get there?
I think it's the point that goes back to the useless eaters. They've never made a secret. They want to get rid of the useless eaters, right?
So
they may pay you, right? They may give you a UBI, but guess what? Even for the adults that are getting UBI, one of the requirements would be like, you're not going to have any kids, right? You cannot be procreating, and then we have to feed your children too, right?
Right.
We cannot have that, right? So if you want to be on UBI, I think one of the requirements, they've already stated it, will be you do not get to procreate. So it's just, a way, number one, of culling the population of the people, of the undesirables. And number two, I think, is getting people used to the fact that anything goes, right? Basically, you have no freedom. You have no rights. Your rights are whatever we say. And by the way, it's not even by elected officials. It's like bureaucrats and administrations proposing these things and more or less ruling by decree. If you remember what happened in Canada when they actually started blocking these people's bank accounts and the transfers that they were making. These people were never even charged with a crime, right?
Wow.
They were basically, the government single-handedly decided, we don't like these people that are on the street, right? We're going to cut off their financial supplies. We're going to cut off the financial, we're going to freeze the accounts of people who donated to those people.
Wow.
So even like a step removed from being a criminal, right? And all of this happened, and basically there was no backlash, but I think they noticed that in America, people are actually all armed and ready to resist. And that's probably why they didn't try. Doesn't mean they're not going to try something similar again. It's the fact that I guess America is a federation and states are so different from each other. They're almost like separate countries, makes it more difficult, not impossible. I mean, I'm sure that they'll try something.
Yeah.
And if they can't, I think that's why they're basically going to start World War III. You can't get all the states to get on board and play ball to basically introduce this horrific agenda. What do? You start something that will basically help you cull the useless eaters, right? And basically, allow you to maybe institute martial law at the federal level, in which case they can impose on the rebellious states whatever the central agenda wants.
Right. And that's what scares me about being a gun owner. And they're making it really easy now to get concealed carry in California. That's weird, right? Like California,
it's very strange.
You can
apply
online right now and you have a very good chance of getting your concealed carry. And a bunch of my friends are like, you should do it. It's so dangerous out there. I'm like, I'm going to walk around with my mace. I'm not taking my weapon anywhere because I'm worried that if you have a concealed carry, they're just going to mark you down. And then when things
of
get really
crazy, they'll mark you down. You'll be the first to round up. Of course.
Right.
You're already sensing it.
Yeah. I think they'll do first is they'll take these IRS agents, these armed feds now that they have, and they'll start to
harass small business owners. Of course. That's the bread and butter. That's the backbone of America. That's the last thing that remains between the useless eaters and the quote unquote utopia, right? Basically, if you're, I don't know if you saw that, but Department of Homeland Security published a list of guidelines of what constitutes a domestic terrorist. And they said several things. I mean, they're not conclusive, but several features are common among domestic terrorists: self-employed, independent-minded, dislike central authority, gun owner, basically lives in a low-tax state. Has doubts about the legality of many of the procedures, medical ones, such as vaccines and many of these things. So all of these things that basically a nice adult thinking person would have without even rebelling. It's just you having these features makes you a candidate for being labeled as a domestic terrorist.
Oh, my goodness. Georgie, it's like, when did this happen? It was like slowly.
Since 2001, mostly. Like 2001 was basically the watershed moment. I mean, we had a situation where 2003 or 2002, when Colin Powell got in front of the United Nations, said Iraq has WMDs, right? And presented all of this evidence that turned out later on, and admittedly by the government, it was actually fabricated.
Right.
Did anything happen to anybody? I don't remember anybody going to jail for fabricating evidence for justifying a war that resulted in the death of over a million innocent people. President Bush was caught recently, and I don't distinguish Democrats and Republicans anymore. I think at a sufficiently high level of power, it's the uniparty, right?
Exactly.
You don't get to that level
the
of power.
Cabal.
the cabal. Exactly. You don't get to that level of power without rubbing shoulders with everybody else, right? There's no enemies there, political. The old friends, the old part of the club, and we are not in it, right?
It's the George Bush, you know, Jr. And Michelle Obama, like
oh, their friendship,
their candies, exactly. That says
it's just
it
crazy. Yeah, so I think it really started back then, and when you get when you have a watershed moment like that, it establishes a precedent that pretty much anything goes. If you can lie openly about launching war on a country, then you basically later on your own government basically establishes that this was completely fabricated, not simply wrong, not that we got it wrong. It was fabricated by the intelligence agencies to justify the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
Not a single impeached individual, not a single person went to jail, not a single person even got tried or charged with a crime. It was all cool. It was all business as usual.
I mean,
once you get people to get used to that, I mean, the rest of the stuff is really, you know, if they're sufficiently dependent, they will go along with just about anything. And now 2/3 of the people are essentially on UBI. So you can tell these people tomorrow to jump off a bridge. You pay them well. And if you convince them that, you know, everything is going to be fine, I wouldn't be surprised if they do it.
Right. And you put them on enough mood stabilizing drugs. You
precisely.
Just that's crazy. And then, you know, also the impeaching, you know, impeaching a president, finding out that that was a complete total fabrication and nobody got in trouble at
nobody.
All.
Nope.
I mean,
nope,
it made,
nope.
we did. I mean, 2001 was definitely a watershed moment, but we had the same thing for Vietnam, didn't we? There was the Gulf of Tonkin that was a complete false flag and total.
Also, you know about that, right? So
oh,
it's
yeah,
actually
man.
Now admitted. There's the National Security Archives, which is a project run by GW University, which is like not even a mile from here. So this professor, I remember it was maybe 2011 or 12. He basically posted this because he digs through the archives. He files these FOIA requests and he gets papers from the government on like things that are already declassified.
Oh,
and this was declassified. And he raised a huge, you know, he made a lot of noise about this. The university threatened him that they will expel him if he continues to talk about this.
Of course.
And he's like, what are you talking about? This is, it turns out that the entire pretext for getting involved in the war in Vietnam was not just a lie. It was actually deliberately, you know, basically like lied and to a degree staged, right? Because there were some shots exchanged, but it turns out there was another American boat that actually shot at the ship, but he didn't hit it. But, you know, so you lied twice. First, you lied that this ship was attacked and damaged or sank or whatever. And then you lied that it was basically the Vietnamese when it was actually our people doing it.
Right.
And they said, nah, you know, he's like, this is declassified. He's like, okay, put it on your public website, but don't promote it, right? Don't promote it. That's the bad, that's the thing that they don't want you to do. If it's there, if the people want to read, they'll go read it. He's like, but how would the people know? How would the people know unless I raise noise about this? It's like, choose. You want to raise noise as a private citizen. That's your liberty. If you leave the university, you will not be associated with the university and raising noise about it.
See, that's the thing that's creepy is all the people surrounding him when he took that info to them and said, check this out. And then they all went, maybe.
Yeah, I don't think.
That's what scares me is your neighbor is like the one who's just like, I'll jump off the bridge, you know, or I'll turn you in. That's
course.
The stuff that's the most
horizontal totalitarianism. That's it's always been existing to a degree, right? But usually people as a group, they know who their enemy is.
Mm.
It's very rare, and I don't know of any other like such large scale event in recorded human history where basically a significant portion of the population says the government can do no wrong, right? We basically whatever they want, we'll follow their, and if tomorrow if they contradict themselves or lie provably every single time. All of this is as if it never happened. I don't know if it's people have gotten, if it's been that dumb or manipulated or frankly lobotomized. Yeah, to that level.
Lobotomized. How about, you know, I was thinking the other day, this is so, it's kind of comical in a horrific way, is like the party of the, of homeschoolers and, you know,
domestic terrorists right there, domestic terrorists.
Right. But remember that used to be the left. The left were the hippies. The left were the ones that wanted free love. Like the liberals that I used to know, I could never imagine them saying, yeah, let the government force us into getting shots. Of course. Like that whole party shifted completely into allowing this totalitarian type of.
True hippies are long gone. Yeah. They're basically, they're either being ostracized or killed or, you know, whatever, but they're no longer. So, you know, the Democratic Party is not really a left party. That's, I keep arguing a lot. I mean, sometimes I go to these like websites that are like Zero Hedge. I don't know if
For
you
sure,
read
of
it.
course, yeah.
Yeah. So they're known as like right leading. And if you look at the comments, whenever there's an article about like the Democrats doing something, then the comments are like, oh, goddamn Bolsheviks, goddamn commies. I'm like, no, they're not. Actually, they somehow managed to combine the worst of both worlds. And that's what really the current Democratic Party and the woke people are. So
right.
So the communists, yes, they said we're going to try to make people equal, but they said if you're able-bodied person, you better work your ass off or we will send you. Don't you ever try to leech off your comrades or we will send you to the gulag. There is actually, I don't know if you know, but there were laws passed in all of the former communist countries. I grew up in one until the age of 12. Laws against social parasitism. And that kind of sounds like a Republican's wet dream. What? Like being a leech is illegal? I'm all for that, right? If you talk to a Republican, they'll say, these people should not be on welfare. These people should find jobs. They're able-bodied. They should work. That's what the commies were saying too, right? Now, this abomination that we're having, that's neither left nor right. It's combining the worst of both, like the authoritarianism really of the, like the, some of the fascist tendencies of the right and some of the, like the parasitism of like of the pathological left. Cause that's really like the risk of both sides. If you have like a party that's on the right, it always is at risk of becoming fascistic, right? Mm. If you have a party that's on the left, it's always at a risk of essentially turning into a party of leeches that don't want to do any work and they want to leech off of the people who are producing something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But back in the day when basically the Soviet Union was around, the commies were commies and the Republicans were Republicans. And if you look at the regular people that were on the ground, they were remarkably similar. They were hard workers. They knew that if you're lazy, that's not a good thing. They also knew that if you're too greedy, that's also not a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow things were going well. At the top, you know, at least on paper, the ideology was different, but the people were almost the same. Now we've gotten something, I don't know, maybe it's really the drugs in the PUFA that's gotten people so damaged that they will basically refuse to acknowledge reality. I think that's really at the core of it, like anti-realism.
Yeah.
It's whatever I decide is the truth. And I don't care about evidence. I don't care about facts.
Yeah.
And I don't care about what my own eyes are telling me. As long as the leaders are saying X, Y, and Z, then I go X, Y, and
Bizarre.
Z. Bizarre. Yeah.
And here we are just, I don't think that I've changed. I think I've been this way. My earliest memories were just one of like the same as I am now, where I just, you know, people should have, you know, just freedom, basically. It's always been the same.
Leave
and
them
I
alone.
Haven't changed that. Yeah.
Yeah, leave
and,
them alone.
Right. It's so interesting. And it's like, I think people are poisoned and it is the poison.
Yeah, I don't even talk about politics anymore from that, because to me, this is very downstream. I have this expression, which Danny like, maybe you like it too, says, I say politics is a metabolite of economics. Economics is a metabolite of human relationships. Human relationships are a metabolite of health. And ultimately, health is a metabolite of metabolism. So if you're getting like a pathology at any of those levels, ultimately it comes down to basically poor health, right? Mental, physical, and that can be done through a number of different ways. Chronic stress, all these psychotropic drugs, poor diet, right? And just generally the system imposing on us like a meaningless existence.
Yeah.
I think that's why we're seeing a skyrocketing of suicides as well. They're saying, no, it's because times are hard financially. They've always been financially hard times, but never such a rate of basically suicides. And now they're trying to actually encourage that even more by saying, guess what? We're going to help you out.
Yeah.
You don't have to be suicidal to commit suicide. If you feel like something is off and you're mature enough, we're going to have this chamber right here for you. You're going to walk inside. You're going to, you know, fall asleep. And that's the end of it.
Oh, man. It just makes me think about how easy it'll be to usher in like AI, you know, with Elon Musk's idea of, because now you don't have to get into the chamber and fall asleep and that's that. You can get into the chamber or you can switch this plate and this thing in your head and you can feel better now. And you can be a new person now. And it's going to be so easy for people because, you know, 20 years ago, you talked to a random person about AI and they're like, I would never do that. I would never want a chip in my head to make life easier, to do whatever. And now people are like, me, please. I'll sign up for the testing subject, you know.
Implant stuff in my head. It's all cool, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and it's just relentless propaganda and just the people that, you know, I do think it's a lot of the psychotropics because they're kind of, you know, destroying your ability to think independently.
Yeah.
I had several posts on the forum and on the blog showing that serotonin basically makes you into a very servile, very obedient, very like, order-following organism. And the study was with horses. In fact, in order for you to break a horse, that's really the process. You're basically raising, you're tormenting the horse to the point where its serotonin levels rise and it basically becomes learned helplessness. And now you have a broken horse. It's no longer wild. That's really the difference. And it's done in horses, but you can do it pharmacologically with drugs by raising serotonin.
Where did the confusion happen? Or was that purposeful as well? Like, where did the confusion happen? Because if you ask anybody on the street or anyone in my group, let's say, what they think of when you hear the word serotonin, and they're going to say happy, the happy drug, it's going to help me not be depressed. Where did that come from?
It came out of the hippie movement, ironically. The government noticed and actually did its own studies. I have to send you some videos that Danny sent me. Basically, you had this group of military soldiers at a military base. And you have the group of soldiers that are basically not taking anything, right? And then they're marching in formation. They're following orders like robots. They move as one. And then they give them a little bit of LSD. And then all hell, quote unquote, breaks loose. Like, they're taking their shirts off. One of them is dancing. The other one is like crawling on the ground. Third one is staring at the sun. Fourth one is singing. And you have like the same drill sergeant, like literally like a beast yelling in their faces. Like, you know, he used to at the previous group, at the same group, but without a drug, they couldn't care less. They turn around, smile on his face, walk, basically ignore him completely.
Wow.
And the government said, oh my God, if LSD usage becomes endemic, it's over. We have no control over these people anymore. So what can we do? Let's look at what LSD does, and let's come up with something that acts in approximately opposite way. So they very quickly realized that LSD is mostly anti-serotonergic and pro-dopamine. And they said, can we come up with something that does the exact opposite? I mean, if you think about it, a servile, dumb, you know, almost like retarded population that follows orders just like those soldiers without any questions asked. That's the wet dream of any autocratic government official, because they think of us, this whole thing of like we being their bosses, they're done with this concept. It's the other way around. They are our bosses, and actually we are their property. So they're saying, can we come up with something that would work, you know, that would oppose the effects of LSD? And, you know, at the time they weren't thinking of mass prescriptions, because nobody was taking drugs on such a mass scale. They were thinking simply of, okay, if the Soviets infiltrate the U.S. population and they convince the population to start taking LSD on mass scale, we're finished as a country. Basically, nobody will listen to anybody else, and it's going to be chaos. So they were designing these drugs with the original idea was to basically like kind of like as a buffer, as sort of like a pushback against the dangers of LSD, which this day they're claiming this is like the worst thing you can ever take.
Right.
You know, it's going to drive you insane and whatnot. And then, you know, in the 80s, Pfizer, and I think Pfizer was the original who created Prozac. I think that was the first SSRI antidepressant that was commercially produced. Pfizer noticed in animal trials that when you give these animals SSRI drugs, basically they stop reacting to any kind of an external stimulus, neither good nor bad. And they said, that's excellent. So this means that we can basically impose a ridiculously harsh environment on these people. If they're taking the SSRIs, they'll accept it. They'll say it's just the way things are. They're not going to revolt. They're not going to ask for anything better. So they said, that's awesome. So they came up with this idea that basically LSD makes people insane. So, and if LSD is anti-serotonergic, then taking something that's serotonergic, the corollary was that it's going to make you sane, right? And then later on, they started pushing this whole crap about serotonin being the happy hormone. They were saying that people who have high dopamine are people who are extremely impulsive. They cannot follow rules. They don't have delayed gratification. And all of these things is stuff that psychiatry says is bad for you, right? Mm-hmm. So if serotonin is opposing these things, the serotonin must be good for you, right? And it's little steps like that. But the really telling thing is that when Pfizer came up with Prozac, and then Prozac was approved for use in the United States, several European countries refused to allow Prozac to be used on their local market because they were extremely concerned about its effects on suicides. They said, this drug makes people commit suicide. We're not going to allow it. And in the United States,
they had done tests, or they just...
They did their own tests, and they looked at the animal tests, and they saw, they basically said, you must be crazy. They also knew the older studies that serotonin produced mostly in the gut. It's never a good signal. You only produce serotonin when something is wrong with your GI tract, right? Like infection or cancer or, you know, many of these things. You know, if you're eating crappy foods, if you get punched in the stomach, right? Any of these things will drastically increase the release of serotonin. They tested. They're saying, no. Serotonin in high doses is prophibrotic, right? We don't know about the long-term effects of Prozac yet. It's definitely not looking good. But what we do know is that basically even Pfizer couldn't conceal that, that SSRI drugs and Prozac at the time was drastically increasing the risk of suicide in the first 2 weeks of its usage. Wow. And Germany said, we're not going to allow this drug. Guess what? The United States called whatever the high-placed government official at Western Germany at the time was and said, no more military aid and no more money for you. The Ruskis are going to walk all over you if we withdraw our military help. So you got to do something about that drug. And lo and behold, basically within like, I don't know, a week or two, the German Federal Drug Agency, whatever it's called, is basically said, okay, we're going to allow it. But they were the first ones, even back then, to put a black box warning on Prozac saying that basically it drastically increases your risk of suicide. Wow. And, you know, little by little, the drug was forced upon other countries as well. And that's how we ended up here. I mean, once a sufficient number of people take it and it becomes the norm, even in children to take it, to medicate children with that, then if you are not taking it, you're becoming the outlier. So even if you're normal, but you're in the minority, eventually, just by the nature of living among such creatures, you become abnormal. You are the outlier. And you start questioning even your own sanity. You'd be like, okay, cannot be such a bad conspiracy. But then you look at the evidence and saying, this cannot be by accident. Right. You don't do 20 things in a row that are leading to this terrible outcome. And all of them basically being like one depending on the other to get to that terrible end effect. This cannot be random. Nature just doesn't work like that, right?
So what do you think about like women like in our group talk about this a lot where they're like, I don't care. It helps me. I do it in, you know, like phases. And I do like 5-HTP, la, la, la. And I have to have it or else I will be so miserable. Like,
Well, a lot of the SSRI drugs, they're really devious. That's why I'm saying to me is there's no doubt this was done on purpose.
Yeah.
All the successful antidepressant drugs have basically activity as cortisol blockers and actually serotonin blockers at the receptor level. So it's really devious. You're given a drug which basically will produce probably an antidepressant effect because blocking excess cortisol and blocking excess serotonin will relieve your depression, right? But at the same time, you're increasing extracellular levels because these drugs are still serotonergic. So while you may be treating your depression, you'll be giving yourself guaranteed fibrosis and potentially cancer down the road because your extracellular levels of serotonin will be rising. So it's really devious. Like you create a drug that makes people actually feel good temporarily at least, but at the expense of just ruining completely their physiological health at a systemic level. Mm-hmm. So to these people, I would say, listen, there are plenty of drugs that are out there which your psychiatrist doesn't talk about, but they actually are approved, that are actually antidepressants and they're anti-serotonergic. Simply ask for those drugs. Miancerin is one of them, also known under the name mirtazapine, I think it's called. Okay. But basically, miancerin is a chemical structure, is very similar to cyproheptadine. It's a serotonin blocker. But guess what? So given now that we have at least one drug that is actually a full serotonin antagonist and it's approved as an antidepressant, don't you think this should completely invalidate the whole theory and immediately get all the other serotonergic drugs withdrawn? Mm. To me, it does. You can't have it both ways. You either serotonin is a happy hormone and cures depression, or serotonin is not a happy hormone and actually may be causing depression. Well, we have the second drug, miancerin, approved in the United States and most of Europe, to treat depression, and its only known effects are to block virtually all of the serotonin receptors. Huh. It doesn't get any clearer than that serotonin is not a happy hormone. There was a big review. There's a lady out at the University of Oxford. She's a psychiatrist, and she published a review that came out, I think it was back in August. You may have seen it on the news. People said it was the final nail in the coffin of the serotonin hypothesis. She said basically zero evidence that low serotonin levels cause depression. In fact, evidence to the contrary, that in most cases of depression, serotonin levels are elevated. This huge noise all over media. And then you see within a week how the lackeys are starting to sort of like make her findings more palatable, saying, yes, this is the finding, but here is why you should not be stopping your antidepressant right now. Mm. Or here is what to ask your doctor to help you put these findings into context. What context can there be? The woman did the largest study ever done on serotonin, and she concluded, and she's a doctor and a psychiatrist, saying, dump your SSRIs right now. If anything, they're going to make you worse, right? Or ask your doctor for an actual anti-serotonin drug. And that's really what you need to take for depression relief. All of that was lost in the noise or was not even discussed on mainstream media. The findings were, first it was, well, it's just one study. We should be really careful. But then if you look at the study, I think as soon as the mainstream media started saying, it's just one study, we should ignore it, then the British Medical Journal and I think JAMA, I was surprised to see those statements there, but they had editorials which said, no, this is the study to look at because it covers everything from the beginning of the SSRI drugs to this point. So we need to go back to the drawing board. That's what the editorials in JAMA and the British Medical Journal said. That's not what mainstream media said. Mainstream media said, if you're taking an SSRI drug, do not stop it. Go talk to your doctor. And what is a regular on the street doctor going to do? Do you think he or she has all of this additional information, is going to go and read 1,000 studies to convince themselves that this works or not? No, they're going to go for the easy solution, which is, well, you've been taking an SSRI drug for the last 10 years. It hasn't killed you. So maybe there are other things that we need to worry about more, you know. So stay on that drug. You know, if there's any, let's see what happens. It's just one study.
Yeah, let's see.
And that's what really happened. That's what ended up happening. It just kind of like got lost in the noise, despite basically even mainstream medicine now, at least the higher levels, the leaders, the health authorities saying the hypothesis is wrong. The drugs may be working and they don't want to say why, right? As I mentioned. Yeah. Some of them are blocking serotonin, some are blocking cortisol. Some of them are increasing the levels of a very beneficial steroid, allopregnanolone, in the brain. Mm. FDA recently approved allopregnanolone by itself as a treatment for postpartum depression. So, like I said, really devious drugs. It cannot be an accident. They were designed in such a way that they may have a partial antidepressant effect, but at the expense of poisoning you serotonergically in every other way. And that's where we are right now. I mean, basically all of these findings, and it's almost as if truth doesn't matter. It's basically truth is right in front of you. But if the expert is not saying it, you basically has gotten to the point where the government is saying, you're not allowed to think for yourself. You're not allowed to interpret reality for yourself. Unless it's done by an expert, the only right you have, if that, is to interpret reality in your little narrow lane. As they say, stay in your lane, right? Mm. So if you're, I don't know, a herpetologist, you can only talk about snakes. You know, if you're, if a bomb explodes next to you, unless a military expert is defining that as a bomb explosion, you cannot be discussing that.
Right. Know? Yeah. How many times I've been hearing stay in your lane with all of these people sending me emails about either their daughters or relatives or friends who are having clotting issues and pericarditis and myocarditis. And, you know, I'm trying to help them with the gut stuff that I know and things. And people are like, stay in your lane. What do you, and it's like, somebody's got to help these people.
If it's not improving, what do you mean stay in my lane? We have two options. Whatever is being done so far is not working. If we can agree on that, there is only two options going forward. Continue doing the same thing, which is Einstein's said is madness, right? A thousand times the same thing and expect a different result. Or do something different. And if the doctor is not willing to do something different, then I will get out of my lane and try to help. It's as simple as that.
Right. And so what is serotonin for? What does it do? Why is it even in us? Why is it necessary?
It's basically sort of like a signal to the body that things are not going well, usually in the digestive tract, to basically increase intestinal motility to basically help excrete whatever this annoying, irritating substance is. Because by increasing, you know, intestinal motility, the passage of the whatever it was ingested will be quicker. Uh-huh. So that's why people with extremely high serotonin have diarrhea. Okay. By looking at their symptoms, medicine came up with, they also have nausea. That's another very common symptom of basically. So the body's saying, raising the levels of a chemical that will make you either puke out whatever you ingested or poop it out, right? Or maybe both. That's why it's a noxious symptom. It's a noxious chemical, and it creates this feeling of general unpleasantness in your body. And recently studies said it's also a metabolic regulator. So if your serotonin levels are chronically high, basically, this is a signal, because serotonin itself is not a good signal. That's a signal that the environment is inhospitable. So what do you do in such cases? Well, you cannot afford the luxury of having reproductive function, higher cognitive function, good mood, etc. What you need to do is basically learn to survive. So serotonin is what puts you back into survival mode. And it really also shifts down your metabolism back to the primitive level, which is mostly glycolysis, right? So you're going to be very inefficient with food. You're going to be eating that food, and a lot of it will be get converted to lactic acid, right? And then it also lowers the levels of ATP in the brain. It's a metabolic regulator. So it's going to turn off your ability for empathy, for basic creativity, for love. There's this famous study that I posted on the forum. The courts agreed. There was this person who was on SSRI, and I think they didn't kill. They wounded somebody, but in a particularly vicious manner. And the lawyer successfully argued that taking an SSRI removes your ability for love, wisdom, compassion, higher cognitive function, and generally human behavior. And the court accepted that argument. So to me, this is yet another irrefutable evidence. Now we have legal precedent saying SSRI drugs will turn you into a monster.
Right.
So the serotonin, the physiological role of serotonin is really that. It's basically if you basically have like in the acute moment, if you're having something that's irritating somewhere, and it doesn't have to be in the stomach. Basically, when you have a wound, you know that initially the wound gets red, right? And if it doesn't get infected, you'll start healing. But while it's healing, you'll start getting the wound in the area starts getting very itchy. Mm-hmm. That's under the influence of histamine and serotonin. So they're also involved in cell division and cell growth. Mm-hmm. So when you have a healing wound, it makes sense that this area around them will be high in serotonin and histamine. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that you want. Like, would you like your entire body to behave and feel like a wound? No, right? Well, that's what high serotonin and histamine will do. Mm. So the acute role of serotonin is basically a danger signal, trying to get, if it's in the GI tract, trying to get you to either excrete it through your mouth or through the rectum. Mm-hmm. And at the chronic level, basically serotonin continues to be elevated. That's a signal for the body that things are basically not going well. The environment is inhospitable, and you need to sort of like scale down your existence so that you can focus on survival.
Wow.
None of these luxurious things that make us human are really compatible with high serotonin.
Right. Like compassion. What about, so could it just be not a wound? Say it's like a ongoing gut issues, leaky gut, candida in the gut.
Yes.
Because I feel like this is just a chronic thing that we see, you know, with all of these women and these hormone issues. It just seems like it's all par for the course with the cortisol and the serotonin and then the SSRIs, and they're trying to manage all this stuff. And meanwhile, it's like their guts are a mess. And
bacterial overgrowth, fungi, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the yeast infection, as you said, all of these things, basically, because the body, the intestine perceives these things as, you know, unpleasant and they shouldn't be there. It will constantly keep producing serotonin. The enterochromaffin cells are called. They're lining basically the intestinal, like the, if you look at intestine as a tube, the lining of the intestine is basically around it, is filled with these cells, and they produce serotonin. And that's really like, that's their role. Basically, something is there that's irritating that area of the intestine, more serotonin will be produced trying to get rid of it. But if it's something like a bacterial overgrowth, it forms biofilm. It forms like this sort of like a, almost like a piece of scotch tape attached to the wall of the intestine. Mm. Then the serotonin is not going to be enough, right? The bacteria is now attached there, and only antibiotics or like things like insoluble fiber in a sufficient amount, or even charcoal, they can literally scrape this away from the intestine. Mm. And then serotonin production will decline. But if you're constantly eating foods that are irritating to the intestine, or you have already established so-called small intestine bacterial overgrowth, SIBO, then you're going to be in a chronic hyperserotonin state. And over time, the gut barrier decline, the integrity of the gut barrier is diminished, mm-hmm. because of this constant inflammatory reaction there. And it's the serotonin and also the endotoxin from the bacteria are now going to enter the bloodstream. And once they enter the bloodstream, then all bets are off. You're going to have like an inflammatory infection, because endotoxin is recognized as the same way as a bacteria would. So the body will actually treat you as if you had a bacterial infection. Mm. You're going to have a fever, which also raises serotonin, right? But the serotonin that was absorbed from the intestine because of the compromised gut barrier now is floating around in the bloodstream, and it can get to the brain. And once it gets to the brain, then you get all of the negative effects, such as, you know, low mood. I mean, low energy really is in the brain.
Yeah.
It's shown that even like a small injection, a small amount injected of serotonin injected into the bloodstream can lower ATP levels by about 30%. At 50% drop, you're actually in a coma.
Wow.
Speaking of coma, not sure how many of your readers know, but when you're under general anesthesia, you're not asleep. That's what the doctors tell you, because they don't want you to freak out. You're actually in a chemically induced coma. And the way the anesthetic drugs work is they interfere with the production of ATP. So you can fully kill a person if you drop their ATP levels in the brain below a certain threshold. If you drop the levels below 50% but above this threshold, this person will be in a state of general anesthesia, which is coma, right?
Wow.
So it shows you that serotonin is kind of pushing you down that pathway. It's just not to the point of getting into a coma, but definitely to the point of 30% drop of ATP levels is going to make you very irritable, potentially extremely aggressive. You're going to snap at the slightest provocation. Sorry. I mean, all of the serial killers that we saw, not the serial killers, but them too, but also the mass murderers over the
Yeah.
last like years that have shot up schools and whatnot. Every single one of them was on an SSRI drug. And this is actually, apparently, this is known. It's known that SSRI drugs induce violent depression, a violent behavior. But guess what the response is? The risk is worth it. We have so many people that are chronically depressed that it's better to treat them and accept that a small percentage of them will lash out and kill the innocents than to leave these people without the proper
I
medical
mean,
care they need.
that's crazy. That
That's
they didn't
maddening,
use
maddening.
that with
Yes.
the vaccine, did they? They
Yeah.
didn't use that logic
Exact
with the
same.
vaccine. The opposite they said. They're like they're saying all these innocent people are going to die, but it's worth it because all these other people are
Will not
having.
die, right? And now it turns out the vaccine actually was not protecting them from this, was not protecting from transmission, was not protecting from any of the things they said they would. And guess what? Did you see the article in The Atlantic? One of the doctors that was at the forefront of this whole pandemic and destroying the unvaxxed because they really are not fit to live in a civilized society. Now she's saying, it's time for amnesty. You
Right.
people have to forgive us
Right.
because we have to
We
make
were in the
peace with each
dark.
other.
We were
We
in
were
the
in the
dark with
dark.
COVID.
I say, go tell this to the people who basically saw their parents dying in nursery homes and saw
Yeah.
them from 30 feet away because they weren't allowed to go any closer.
Right.
Go tell this to the people who basically who got rejected from transplant lists and transplant
Right.
surgeries because they weren't vaccinated, right?
Right.
You kill all these people. You are a mass murderer by definition.
Yeah.
Once you get through a regular, I don't know, like a proper trial and you get your sentence, then maybe we can talk about forgiveness and moving on.
Yeah.
But not for me. I mean,
No.
you should ask for forgiveness from the people who actually who whose families and lives are destroyed. How many people were fired from their jobs for
So
refusing to
many
vaccinate? How many people
people.
were basically when they fired, they got lost their health insurance, right? What if they were supporting a family? What happens? Imagine that now you and your husband, you go down to one income, and then imagine if this was at a company that basically company says, "Kitty, you're not vaccinated, out on the street." You
Yeah.
know what happens? And they're like, "Well, what can we
Yeah.
do? We were in the
We're in the
dark." No,
dark.
you weren't. We were
Yeah.
saying from
And
day
where were
one.
we? Yeah.
Yeah,
Was I wasn't in the dark. I saw it.
there was evidence saying that this is not the case, and they were saying, "No, we'll suppress that. You're
Yeah.
evil. You should. No, we'll not allow you to do that." That I do not forgive. Now, if you were truly in the dark, and let's get in front of a court. Let's present all the evidence, and we present all the evidence of censorship and whatnot. But look, it really there's no need for this. You already know. You already sense it.
Right.
I
Yeah.
used to work with a guy who was my direct boss. He was a special ops soldier, former. So he's, had a lot of war experience. Like he was in a, he said he was in an environment for 25 years that wouldn't forgive even one error, or you're dead, right? He probably did some kind of like, I don't know, black ops work. He was saying, look, son, at the end of the day, life comes down to two very simple rules. Rule number one, it's all about the little voice inside you most civilians don't even hear. Rule number two, when that little voice tells you that there's even a shred of doubt, then there is no doubt. And basically, the people who, and that's really what the system tries to kill. You listening, you even hearing that voice, let
Yeah.
alone listening to what this little voice is telling you. I think women are, I don't want to say privileged, but you have an advantage on males because naturally you tend to listen to your gut feeling more. Men are like, no, I have to be logical. I have to
Yeah.
like do use this abstract thinking to solve this complicated problem.
Yeah.
Very few things in life are that complicated. So it's usually your gut, sort of gut feeling, which is really evolution, intuition that's evolved for 4 billion years, if not more. Why would I not trust that versus some, I don't know, whatever the expert is telling me?
Yeah.
Expert spent 20 years honing his powers of abstract thought, but I have something that evolved over 4 billion years. To me,
Yeah.
it's a no-brainer, but the system
There,
says, no, you do
right.
not listen to that. You are a domestic terrorist. If
Right.
you listen to your intuition, Kitty, you're a domestic terrorist.
There was this meme that said, It said, trust my gut. You mean the thing that doesn't even digest dairy? Yeah,
Well,
but you know, the other thing that, yeah, that's a different subject, right?
hello. Quick interruption to tell you about the in-home dried urine Dutch Complete hormone test. It's not enough to just know your levels, high or low, but for example, what are you doing with your estrogen? Is it being pushed down unhealthy, potentially dangerous pathways that could lead to breast or prostate cancer, fibroids, or insulin resistance? Or are you converting your testosterone into estrogen and having hair loss and low libido? Or are your adrenals burnt out and at the root of all your hormonal struggles? No point in guessing. I love this test. I take it once a year and it keeps me on track with my goal of aging gracefully. Use your coupon ED25, as in estrogen dominance 25, and get $25 off your test interpretation and 6 week program of supplement, detox, and dietary recommendations. I have 5 years of experience reading and interpreting this test and was trained by the makers Precision Analytical. Coupled with my gut health expertise, and this program is about as comprehensive as you're going to get. Check it out in the show notes for more details.
The other thing that happened, not just these extreme horrible cases of, you know, people lo watching their parents die on an iPad, but just what happened to the whole world. Like, you know, that was the most divisive thing that I think has probably ever happened to us as a humanity. Like, it completely segregated from COVID to the vaccine. And they're blaming it on Trump, and they're blaming it on Biden, and they're blaming it on all these things. It's just that the whoever perpetrated this madness, you know, created this division where your own neighbor, who you've been friends with for years, all of a sudden sees you as the enemy. I mean, that was the worst thing, I think,
It's a
of.
very well-established technique in animal research. It's called redirected aggression. So if you have actually, and basically in animal research, this is actually considered unethical behavior and animal torture, animal cruelty, and it's prosecutable and it's a felony in most states of the world. So what really this means is that if you put up an animal under pressure, a pressure that the animal cannot escape from, because a sane animal will try to escape or fight back, right? But if you're preventing both responses, then if it's a group of animals, eventually they turn on each other because that's their only mechanism of venting. And it's called redirected aggression. And it's basically, that's why, like, when you have, like, when you go to the zoo, in most cities in the States and even Europe, it's very, like, they're very careful when they do construction around the zoo or like any kind of a remodeling work because the animals get stressed and then they lash out at each other if this continues for too long. So that's what they did really with the humans. They created a situation where humans had a threat, an invisible, horrific threat, which was what was explained on TV, right? And basically, they were told they were completely helpless against this threat, except through the vaccine. So if you convince people that this is their only way out of a potentially life-threatening situation, and then you tell them, look at this smaller group here. They're trying to interfere with your access to this like life-saving intervention. Well, of course, people will lash out, right? I mean, of course, you can blame them for being dumb and believing that, but that process has been going on for decades. This is already complete. So really, to me, the scariest thing of this whole thing is not the elite at the top. They've always been psychopathic. Not even the economic collapse, right? Not even World War III. Because next time we have a podcast with Ray, I'm going to ask him the question. Say, imagine you have magic powers. Tomorrow, you decide basically at the wave of a hand, all of the problems that we're facing now is from the powers that be disappear. We still have to live with these people who are basically incapable of wiping their own nose and basically willing to oppress you to death. How do you have society and civilization with people like that? So
Well,
I don't have a solution.
you just described certain people who, like the people who are sort of like on, you know, the universal income type of people who are just like lazy and just checked out. But what about the people, these intelligent, really, like, you know, I got back on Twitter and now I'm going to get back off because I just can't believe it. It's
It's
that
just toxic,
it's
too
just
toxic.
the denial of reality that you were talking about, but it's so toxic. Yeah, but you know, these people who are smart scientists, lawyers, you know, politicians, bureaucrats, these people, like, let's, you know, they're scary because they're actively pursuing to
course.
Continue this narrative. I didn't mean like politicians who are high up. I just mean like, you know, the lower level people who are active in your local government and stuff like that. They're the ones that I'm scared of too, because
yeah, they have to double down, because otherwise they will, if at some point, get legally prosecuted. I mean, if you, the response to that article in The Atlantic was, listen, there's no forgiveness for this.
Right.
The first step to this will be all of you that got involved in this, you basically go on a trial and let's see what the trial says. Let's present the evidence, right? Because it's really also a test for the legal system as well. If it turns out that the legal system will not even accept such irrefutable evidence of collusion, of aggression, of oppression, then the people who actually they were wrong, they need to make some very hard decisions. Do we split off completely as groups and like live separately, or what do we do? Because currently, in the current situation, we're incompatible as at the social level, as species with those people.
Right. Like,
and I think they sense
you,
it. Yeah, they sense it. And they're saying, I'm going to double down, because basically if I admit that all of this, just like the war in Iraq, if I admit for, I mean, eventually they admitted it was a lie, right? But it took 10 years.
Yeah.
I think the final official admission that all of this was a scam was around 2013. And 2003 is when the war officially, like the military, remember Bush, he claimed he flew on this like aircraft carrier, and they had this banner, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
Anyways, 10 years later, or at least 11 years later, after Colin Powell was in front of the UN and saying, you know, Saddam Hussein has WMDs, right?
Right.
10 or 11 years later, they finally admitted, it's like, no, he didn't, but it was still worth it. And then it took another 10 years, so it was like 9 years or something. Like last year, Bush was giving a speech and he made a mistake. He was trying to tell that, not last year, like this March, he was saying, wanted to say President Putin launched a completely unjustified war in Ukraine, but he said that he launched a completely unjustified war on Iraq, which was very morally wrong. It was based on a lie.
Yeah.
And then he called himself, he started laughing, right? But then there was, they asked some of his advisors after he gave the speech, and they said, well, I think at this point, it's, you know, I don't even know. They asked him, like, was this really like a fake war? I mean, was this really war completely unjustified? And they were saying, I thought this has already been cleared up. I mean, like, why are we even asked this question? It's obvious. And they say, well, what now? And they say, nothing.
Right.
What now? It happens. Shit happens.
Right.
You roll with it, right?
Right. Was it cleared up? You're the one who had the, you know, who had the Freudian slip up there.
Yeah.
Not us.
Yeah.
You had
Not
the
us.
Freudian slip. And after he said it, he laughed. But then
he laughed. Yeah.
But then he went, that's, I guess it's true.
Yeah, it's kind of true. Yeah, you know, it's kind of true.
Yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
like, the nerve this person has. And by the way, now he's not a president anymore. Prosecute the damn freak. Like,
right.
just get him, like him or whoever was responsible, because he didn't single-handedly decide tomorrow I'm going to invade Iraq. This was well planned. Now we have evidence it was planned as far back as 1999. So find those people who planned this invasion, this war, without any evidence, right? And then try them. Because if you don't, then I think one of the reasons we're in this situation is because the people, the two-thirds, the oppressors, your neighbors and my neighbors, and even relatives, they're basically seeing what's happening at the top and they're saying anything goes.
Yeah.
Apparently, justice is dead. It's basically whatever you can get away with, and that's devastating to society and civilization. Because especially children are looking. You know, you try to raise your children to be good, upstanding citizens, right? That they, you know, respect their fellow men at least as much as they respect themselves. But then the children are looking at you and saying, and let's say like 10 yards away from you, you have these beasts, the vagrants, beating the crap out of each other over like a blunt, right?
Yeah.
And they're looking at that, they're listening to you, and what do you think the children will internalize? They'll say, mommy or daddy, you're out of your mind. I see how the world works, right? Children trust their sense because they're born with it. And unfortunately, we don't, but they do. And they look around them and they observe how adults behave. And you may think that if you give them this lecture for an hour about how things should be and how they should behave, at the end of the day, they're just going to brush it aside and go with their gut instinct and what they see on the street, because that is real life.
Right.
And that's really the most devastating thing that I've seen lately, is that most of the people are saying, even if I'm wrong, even if I'm evil, what are you going to do about it?
Remember
the Weinstein thing, when they were like, before the trial, it was just the beginning of the Me Too movement. There was this guy, Weinstein and some other guy were thinking, were either Las Vegas or maybe California in some bar. And a guy, one of the clients there, got up and like, you know, engaged Weinstein, and they had this back and forth. And eventually, the guy punched him. But
I don't remember
they had
that.
a video. I'll send you the video where basically, like, the guy was like, "How dare you sit there? You raped all of these women. You did all these nasty things and whatnot." And Weinstein turns around and says, "Yeah, and what are you going to do about it?
Oh my
Squat. You
goodness.
can't do squat."
Right.
And I'm like, that's the attitude. And I think that's why he got convicted, because technically they didn't have much of a, in terms of direct evidence. It was all testimony from people that for stuff that happened 20 years ago.
Right.
Normally, if he was actually better behaved and he wasn't so arrogant about his ways, I think he would have walked away. But that's what got people. And this video is still out there. He was basically saying, "I can do whatever I want. Who are
Right.
you? You're just a pleb. You know, I can crush you any way I want."
Well, but there was some justice there, some.
There was some justice there, yeah.
Yeah.
But I would like to see the exact same thing extended to everybody in a position of power that made decisions that led to basically, my God, where do I start? Like, even if we, aside from the elderly people that died, did you see the results that came out of the educational achievements? They're now saying two
Yeah.
or three generations of the youngest children, the ones that were in pre-K, first and second grade, their academic career is irreparably damaged. Because apparently that early in life, it's very important that they get the proper education and cohesion in school. Because if they
Right.
don't, this deficit is going to follow them in life for the rest of their life. So
Yeah.
now we have three, like basically we have like a generation of children that has been completely handicapped in school and nothing is happening. Like,
Right.
so that's why this call for amnesty and forgiveness, not with me. I mean, I
Yeah.
saw what happened to my children. So, like I said, let me see people in prison, I mean, tried properly
Yeah.
and, you know, handed at the appropriate sentence. If that happens, then I will have some faith that the current structure works. If that
Right.
doesn't
Well,
happen, then it
yeah.
doesn't.
I mean, that's what we're already seeing, though. We're seeing all these crazy, things go to trial, and then the judges are letting things go,
Yeah.
and the with the dossier and all of that. It's like, how did that, they found them guilty and then they
Yeah.
let them walk.
They
And
just
so,
admitted that he completely concocted this stuff out of thin air. And
yeah.
this person is still in the force. Peter Dursak, whatever his name is, or yeah, he's still an agent. How is this possible?
Right.
He gets implicated at basically cooking up a compromise, as they call it, the French, that affected potentially, that led to the impeachment, unsuccessful, but led to the impeachment of a sitting president, and nothing is happening to that person.
Nothing is happening. And people are just okay with it.
Yeah,
Like
and
they're
people on the street saying, "Well,
clear,
why
like
do you
what?
care about this? Why do you
Yeah.
care about this?" I'm like, "Because it
Yeah.
affects your daily life. How does it affect my daily life? I'm going to go to the bar, get drunk, watch football." Yeah, but at the end of the
Yeah.
day, that's not what life is all about. Maybe you
Right.
should think that if you're feeling depressed and hopeless and you know your life sucks, that's because your life has degraded to doing only these couple of things.
Yes.
Well, Georgie, like, why are you ruining my mood? Like, I don't need you. My life already sucks enough. Well, it does. Let's talk
Right.
about why. No, I don't want to talk about this. Why not? Because then I have to pop another pill. That's another thing
You're
that we need to
stressing
talk
me
about.
out. But then there's the other person, like my mother, who is like, I don't want to know because there's nothing I can do about it. So I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to know nothing.
I think that's a false dichotomy. Like, there's few things you can do about it, but in reality, this people's entire power depends on us. Remember the currency that they're using, the fake currency to inflate and pay for all these wars and our oppression and paying the pharmaceutical companies. All of these is fiat currency. It does not
Right.
have any value if the people stop supporting it, right?
Right.
And it's kind of already starting, I mean, to go in this direction.
Yeah.
But most of these people, their power is paper power. They're paper tigers.
Yeah.
They're only as strong as what the population is willing to give them in terms of power. And I think just the idea of knowing about this and knowing that, you know, that they're up to something, it's sufficient to foil many of their plans.
Yeah.
Now, it's not a pleasant thought to live with, but as Voltaire said, what is it, 300, 400 years ago? There are only two ways to live your life: convulsive anxiety or lethargic boredom. He says, and I never saw a person in the second state ever live a good life or make progress. So, not wanting to know, right? It's going to give you the lethargic boredom. You're not going to be bothered by anything. But even that, I don't think is guaranteed, because things are developing and going in a direction that the people who want to remain ignorant, they can no longer be. It's just
Right.
way too much going on in the world for them to, unless you're in a very rural area in the middle of
Yeah.
nowhere,
Or you're
then yes.
old, because
Yeah,
she's
we all.
older and she doesn't really partake in society anymore. So it's like, you know, but she's there watching TV, watching the news, getting
So why is
brainwashed.
she watching if she doesn't want
Yeah,
to know?
exactly. Well, she's watching it's the stuff that I'm telling her she doesn't want to know.
Okay.
You
I
know, the
see, I
things,
see.
right, when I'm telling her, Mom, you can't pay attention to that because of this and this. And she's like, I don't want to know about that. I don't want to believe that everyone who's in control of the world is evil. That's what she says.
That's really that's how I guess it's, I mean, call it human nature and whatnot.
Yeah.
What was that expression of Yoda from Star Wars? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So
Right.
if you get these people up there and they've been there for generations, this whole thing about politics being a career, that did
Yes,
not exist
right.
before the 1950s.
I know.
It's like
Why, how in the
people,
world? Yeah.
yeah,
How is
people will
this
do
going
a
to happen?
term and they'll get kicked out, or like not go back on their own volition. You know, in
Right.
Texas, apparently, like there's no such thing as a professional politician. They're all doing this on the side. That's just how the Constitution of Texas is designed. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. But
So
I thought that's how we
judges,
were all supposed to be.
that's how we're supposed to be, and that's how it
Yeah.
used to be for many states, but not anymore. Now I think Texas is probably one of the few examples where you can point to and say, look, every single person in the state house and the state senate, that's not their job.
Right.
They're actually employed in doctors, lawyers, construction workers, whatever you want to call it, and they are in their spare time, they go, like whenever the legislative body convenes to vote on laws or debate things, and that's in their free time, right? That's truly contributing to your community without
Right.
getting paid for it. I don't think they're even getting salaries for that, for many of these things. So that's how I think it should be. It's like you should
Yeah.
be there, not because if you're making money out of this thing, you'll in most cases you'll do everything possible to maintain that stream of income.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
Did you see what Pelosi is making now and what their incomes have increased to? It's outrageous. I don't remember the
outrageous. They're
numbers,
doing
but
insider trading.
and
They
then
most of
you
the
look
members
at,
of Congress, they can
right.
do insider trading. They look, think of
Madness.
this. Pelosi, being the Speaker of the House, she has access to the proceedings of every committee at the congressional or Senate level. Some of these committees are committees on financial oversight, committees on economic development, committees on this and that and this. So she knows every single time when a Senate or Congress is about to decide on something that affects a publicly traded company. So she can trade weeks, if not months, in advance accordingly. That's the definition of insider trading.
I mean,
That's worse. Yeah.
who's letting that happen? You
It's
know, that's.
completely legal. Apparently, there's no law passed against it. It's not just her. I don't want to pick on her. Most members of Congress and Senate are allowed to vote on things that their committee is working on. I'm not vote, but like
Wow.
trade. Yeah.
Trade.
To me,
I mean.
that's the re that alone is probably sufficient to make them multimillionaires. And that's really is basically probably why being a congressman and a senator
Yeah.
is so in such high demand.
I mean,
You
if they
know. It,
stopped that, if they weren't allowed to do that, they probably would change
I.
jobs.
They'll be like, yeah. Then you'll try to reelect and say, nah, I don't want that
I'm
job. No, you
good.
have no. You do
Oh my God, that's disgusting. Yeah, and I think I just read that Donald Trump, I don't know how true this is, but he actually lost a bunch of money while he was president. He actually did not take he didn't take the president's salary, but then he also lost, like as his total earnings, he lost a bunch of money.
Yeah,
So he
the
actually.
hotel he bought the old what is it called? The post office in DC, which is this really nice sort of like aristocratic, like glamorous looking building downtown.
Yeah.
It's actually across the street from the FBI and about a block from the White House. He converted it to a hotel and whatnot. And basically, after the impeachments, people stopped going there. The value of the building of the entire franchise went down. It's just, I guess, it's just like a market. It's based on public perception. So he bought it for, say, 500 million, but then eventually he actually sold it not too long ago. And I think he sold it at a significant loss. He sold it for, like,
Wow.
I don't know, maybe 200 million. Now, many people say, well, this is just paper money. I mean, paper money, but he paid, like, he did pay him out of his pocket. It wasn't like based on like debt or something. He paid
Yeah.
it in cash. And then he was forced to sell it because he thinks that his reputation now is so damaged that nobody will go, DC being a huge Democratic city, nobody will go there anymore. And it just sits there like a, I don't know, like an abandoned house, like a condemned house. So he sold it.
Wow. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you about cortisol
Oh, sure.
and about serotonin has the, you know, they work so similarly, but I Constantine and I, who couldn't make it today, we got into this conversation about I got this like eczema thing, and a lot of women talk about this, especially as they're going through menopause and they have these outbreaks of eczema, and nothing was helping. And I started taking Benadryl. I took all these creams and stuff. It was like on my hands and feet. None of it helped. I just started taking Benadryl, and not only did the Benadryl help, but it just really made me feel better in general. Now, is that because it's clearing serotonin? What is it doing? Why does it work that way?
It also, eczema is very closely related to estrogen. They noticed years ago, if not even decades, that when they were giving women anti-estrogenic drugs for their breast cancer, very often the ones with eczema had the eczema completely clear away. So it's known in endocrinological circles that eczema is very closely related to cortisol, estrogen, and or serotonin, and they happen to promote each other. But Benadryl is basically, first of all, it does have anti-serotonergic properties in lower doses, but it's also an antihistamine and an anticholinergic. And it turns out that if you can block the cholinergic system and the histamine system, estrogen becomes completely benign. So all of the negative effects that estrogen is capable of inflicting are through one or both of these systems. So an antihistamine and an anticholinergic drug, by the way, cyproheptadine is another one, but Benadryl is a stronger anticholinergic than cyproheptadine, is going to act as an effective, as a functional antiestrogen, even though it's not going to eliminate estrogen from your body. So by blocking the effects of estrogen, you're effectively preventing whatever this pro-eczema effect of estrogen is. And also the anti-serotonin effects probably help for the general sense of well-being. Because, like I said, serotonin really the role is a signal. It's the way for the environment to tell the body, to tell your brain that things are not going well, right? And for you to become to basically kind of scale down your existence, especially your higher cognitive function. So, higher serotonin means you're going to turn into a more primitive version of yourself that cares only about basic physiological needs, and everything is a threat. That's really
Right,
the one way to
right.
describe high serotonin state. Everything is a threat. Everything is an irritant.
Yeah. I mean, that really just explains like perimenopause and menopause and PMDD and all of it, it's just that is everything feels like a threat. Everything is anxiety. I have this theory that as we age, our the estrogen goes into the tissues and then it's no longer in the blood. So you're not really seeing it in blood serum labs. So you've got this estrogen in the tissues, and then women look at their labs and they say, "Oh, I don't have any estrogen. I have no estrogen. I better start taking estrogen." And so this problem with like, well, that's because you don't have progesterone to oppose the estrogen that was in the blood, the estrogen goes into the tissues. I don't know. Am I making any coherent
No,
sense
actually, we
here?
confirmed this. I think I mentioned in one of the emails that now my research group in Bulgaria, we launched a service for testing steroids in hair and nails.
Right. So that
And
was my
because,
next question.
yeah, hair and nails, because they're composed of cells, which then become keratinized as they get sort of like excreted out of the skin, right? Then basically, if you look at the contents, the steroid contents of these former cells, then you're basically getting an idea of the levels of steroids in tissues in general. And we've already confirmed in another study out of China, a very large study of over 240 women, I'm going to send it to you. It did this amazing, like an entire battery of tests analyzing steroids in the hair of these women. And they had them stratified by age groups, right? They had young, middle-aged, and menopausal. And everything that Dr. Pete said about estrogen and thyroid actually was confirmed, and even progesterone. What did they find? That the levels of estradiol in hair not only did not decline with age, it actually increased. The highest level of estradiol in hair was seen in the menopausal group. So you cannot be in an estrogen deficiency if your cells, where estrogen works, is actually oversaturated with estrogen. Number one. Number two, levels of T3, the active thyroid hormone, drastically decline with age, which is another thing that Dr. Pete has been saying, and it probably most easily explainable and very easily visible to most non-medical people by saying, look, we all tend to gain weight as we age. Why would we gain weight? Well, you're not expending it, you're not burning these calories. And what's responsible for your metabolic rate at the very top, the master conductor? Thyroid hormone. So they found the thyroid hormone declining. They also found progesterone declining with age. Of course, it was the lowest in the menopausal women. Another thing they found out is that, not sure how many of your readers know, but it's not just the absolute levels of estrogen and progesterone, but it's their ratio. So if you look at the progesterone to estradiol, or total estrogens, but the majority is estradiol, then it should be at least 100 to 1, at least 100 to 1. And they found out that not only is not 100 to 1, but in menopausal women, it gets closer to about 5 to 1, which is an extreme state. Another way of saying that menopausal women are in an extreme state of estrogen dominance or progesterone deficiency, relative, no matter how you want to look at it. Another thing they found out is that obesity strongly correlates with age and, of course, inversely correlates with T3 and progesterone, and very strongly correlates with estradiol and cortisol. So everything that Dr. Pete said about tissue estrogen versus blood, progesterone production, and how these things should be correlated, you know, as a ratio, all of this was confirmed by a very large institute, medical institute in China. Mm-hmm. But we now have our own analysis lab established to do both nails and hair, and we're seeing the exact same thing.
And
so to me, there is no
time,
doubt.
So someone like me, so I'm going to be 53. So, and I'm just getting into menopause. So does that, you know, do I want to wait until I'm into full menopause, or is it already going to show up in hair?
It will show up. It already shows up. Basically, there are established normal ranges for hair, less so for nails, but now we've established them because we have about 200 volunteers. But for nail, they're published normal ranges, just like they're for blood. For hair, they're published normal ranges for most steroids. So there is a normal range for estradiol. And basically, when you analyze the hair, if it falls below, which is very rare, or above, then it, you know, this means you're in a state of basically the acute estrogen is too high. Or if both are in range, but then the ratio of progesterone to estrogen is not at least 100 to 1, that also gives you an idea that you're in a state of relative estrogen excess. And basically, the range is really, the studies that I've seen show that the normal range doesn't really change much with age. Now, the medicine is claiming that it should change because they're saying, well, you know, menopausal women don't have estrogen, so we have to kind of artificially lower the range. But there's no clinical evidence for that. The ranges published for hair do not change based on age, which means that it's with advancing age, as your estradiol becomes higher and higher in the cell, eventually you actually cross the normal range for the levels of estrogen in your cells. And that's really what matters, not what's in your blood. The blood is just a transport mechanism, nothing more.
Right. So why is it then that women take the estrogen and feel better with a lot?
Because
of
it suppresses
things.
The pituitary, and most of the pituitary hormones are highly inflammatory. So when your ovaries are not working well, and the same thing happens in men, when their gonads, the testicles are not working well, the pituitary initially starts to pump out a lot of luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, so LH and FSH. TSH also is another one if you're hypothyroid, right? Prolactin. And when you take estrogen, because estrogen establishes a negative feedback mechanism, and it's one of the most potent suppressors of LH and FSH. It does stimulate prolactin, but in some cases it may lower TSH as well. So when you're taking, and all of, like I said, all these hormones have very well established pro-inflammatory effect, almost none of the pituitary hormones really is desirable. In fact, they found out if you remove the pituitary of animals, they live about 40% longer than animals that have their intact pituitary. There was the famous researcher that Dr. Pete often quotes who was convinced that we produce a death hormone, and he spent his life looking for it. And he basically got convinced toward the end of his life when he was analyzing these animals that it is definitely coming from the pituitary and is probably similar in structure to prolactin. Or one of the other pituitary hormones. So what estrogen does initially is it suppresses these hormones and you're going to feel better. Inflammation is going to drop. But because you're taking this estrogen, over time, estrogen basically increases the synthesis of prostaglandins from the polyunsaturated fats, increases the synthesis of nitric oxide, increases the synthesis of serotonin, increases the synthesis of cortisol. So chronically, estrogen is going to absolutely wreck you. But initially, you're going to get like a brief stage of relief, maybe for about a week or two. But invariably, I've never seen a woman who takes only estrogen and basically like these beneficial effects that the woman loved remained. Over time, basically started feeling worse and worse. And that's actually the best way to realize that this is the case, that even pharma industry has now moved away from giving women only estrogen as a birth control pill. They now basically almost universally either combine it with a progesterone, synthetic one, or even give a synthetic progesterone by itself to relieve menopausal symptoms or to serve as a birth control pill. They know that while estrogen will make you feel good in, you know, the first couple of weeks, over time it will devastate you and most likely give you cancer. So that's why even the pathological pharma industry no longer works only with estrogen. They at least give you a progesterone, which of course doesn't do much good, but it may balance some of the estrogen's effects. And now actually moving towards completely phasing estrogen out and giving women, putting women on a synthetic progesterone, preferably for life. They're saying, you know, we know progesterone is good. They've admitted it. But don't take this bioidentical progesterone. Right. It's quickly excreted. And, you know, it's hard to control what dosage you're getting. By the way, we have a much more potent agonist of the progesterone receptor. Here's these 20 synthetic poisons that we have for you.
Great. Although, yeah, it is true. It's hard to dose it for sure, progesterone. But why would taking estrogen help normalize blood sugar levels? That's a big thing too. A lot of women, especially older women who are, you know, postmenopausal, who even my mom, for example, if she does not take her estrogen, she will go, she'll have, you know, blood sugar attacks. Like she'll have.
So estrogen is raising blood sugar levels, but the reason this is happening is because estrogen stimulates lipolysis. So when you stimulate lipolysis, you're releasing fat from your bloodstream. And due to the Randall cycle, basically the cell can only metabolize what you give it through the environment, which is through the blood, right? The cell has very limited resources inside of itself that it can consume before it dies. So it's almost entirely dependent on what you provide externally. And whatever you provide, the cell can only oxidize at a time, either glucose or fatty acids. So if you're raising, basically by increasing lipolysis, if you're raising the levels of free fatty acids, a lot of that sugar that's reaching the cell will become unmetabolized because the cell cannot deal with it currently because it's stuck in oxidizing mostly fat. So because the more of the sugar will get unmetabolized, it will accumulate in the blood. But if you give an extreme dose of estrogen, you can actually cause diabetes through the exact same symptom, through the exact same mechanism. And also because estrogen is cytotoxic to the beta cells in the pancreas. But at moderate doses, you can achieve hyperglycemia in people and giving them temporary diabetes type 2 simply by giving a sufficiently high dosage of estrogen. Now, if the blood sugar is dropping precipitously in older women, then I would simply try to eat the sugar. I think it really depends on what kind of sugar is being eaten. And it may be an issue with liver. Broda Barnes published a book saying that basically hypoglycemia, it's not your brain, it's your liver. So it's very common. Recent studies have shown that about 70% of Americans have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD. In other words, the majority. Basically, but through the fattening of the liver cannot store a sufficient amount of glycogen. So basically, when the cells need glucose, the first thing that should happen in a healthy person is the liver should release some of glycogen because that's where it's mostly stored. Muscles can also store a decent amount of glycogen, but it's mostly the liver. Now, if your liver is diseased and cannot store as much glycogen because it's full of fat, then basically the cells can only rely on what's outside. And if they metabolize the glucose, right, then they run out of glucose. And if the liver cannot provide it, you get hypoglycemia response. So estrogen is preventing that, but through a very bad mechanism, by shifting your metabolism towards the oxidation of fat. So what really you should be doing is basically doing things that stimulate the liver and helping it get rid of its fat, such as niacinamide in doses under 500 milligrams daily, aspirin, vitamin E, vitamin K, gelatin and or glycine, like the taurine is another amino acid that's also very good. So all of these things over time will help your liver recover. And then the liver should, a healthy liver should be able to store about 500 grams, about a pound of glycogen. And that is enough to prevent hypoglycemia episodes, even at night. You know, let's say like you have a good meal, or actually you don't eat at night, but you go to sleep. And then that's actually one of the best signs of whether your liver is working properly or not, is how often at night do you wake up. The more often you wake up, the poorer your liver function is, because it means you have run out of glycogen. And you have to wake up like several times at night to kind of refeed yourself because you're getting into these hypoglycemia episodes.
Wow. Okay, one last thing. although I could go down that rabbit hole some more. But so we did it. We did the Luna Madre, Ona's Made of Pregnenolone, with 100 milligrams each pump. And
Nice.
I wanted to clear off completely my progesterone, because that's all I've been taking hormone-wise. So I stopped taking all of progesterone just so I could try this and test it, you know, myself. And
Yep, just bring them.
ironically, I actually slept. I don't sleep through the night. I get up at least once, and I slept through the night after about 5 days of using this. But I felt really thirsty like the last couple of nights, and I didn't want to drink before bed, so I didn't. Woke up in the morning, was just like so thirsty, ridiculously thirsty. Just tested my blood sugar 2 days in a row. It was 119, and I'm like
119.
119, and I'm
Okay.
like, what is going on here? Because I haven't changed anything else except for getting off the progesterone.
Okay.
So I'm just like, wonder what that's about. So I wanted to talk about just pregnenolone in general, but what you think of that?
So if you're so you're saying like the blood sugar rose after you stopped progesterone?
It
The
seems like
blood
that
sugar
might be
started
what happened.
rising. Yeah.
I stopped progesterone and I started pregnenolone. I don't know if the
Okay.
pregnenolone is what did it, or if just being off the progesterone in general is what.
I would say it's probably the latter. Pregnenolone, I'm sorry, progesterone has a very strong anti-cortisol effect, and basically cortisol and blood sugar have a one-on-one relationship. Many people think of cortisol as the anti-inflammatory hormone, but it turns out its primary role in the organism is preventing your blood sugar from dropping too low, because then you go into a coma. Not sure how many people know, but diabetic people who cannot regulate blood sugar at all, if they inject too much insulin or if their blood sugar drops too low, they go into a hypoglycemic coma and they can die from that. It's really dangerous. So basically, the role of cortisol is the emergency supplier of glucose. And how does it supply the glucose? By shredding anything in your body that's made up of amino acids, and then the liver converts those amino acids into sugar.
Oof.
And basically, that's the sugar you get. So having higher blood sugar without doing anything, I don't know, like eating too much blood sugar or doing anything other crazy like an exhaustive exercise, having high blood sugar is now known to be not due to a dietary problem, to a dietary regime. And even people treating patients with diabetes type 2 have now said that gluconeogenesis, which is the conversion of amino acids into glucose, is responsible for probably at least 90% of that blood sugar that we're seeing in the blood in people with type 2 diabetes. That means their diet is not the problem, or at least it's not the sugar in their diet that's the problem, even though they're being told to restrict it. But what's the problem? Cortisol. Cortisol stimulates gluconeogenesis. Cortisol supplies the raw material for gluconeogenesis. And several studies are now using the anti-cortisol drug, which most women know as the abortion pill, but it was actually designed as a cortisol blocker, mifepristone, also known as RU486. They're now actually having clinical trials showing complete cure of type 2 diabetes with this drug, and key, sustained weight loss in obese women who have basically extra weight due to excess cortisol. So really, now another indication that obesity is nothing but an endocrine disorder.
So
So the
wait a
way
second.
the
So that drug, the abortion pill, that's not plan B, is it? I thought that was all like
No,
made with progesterone.
plan B
Okay.
is when you're actually still preventing the pregnancy. I think
Okay.
plan B, the drug is called Norgestrel.
Oh, that's which
It's
is a
type of a
progestin.
synthetic, yeah, it's a synthetic
Okay.
progestin.
Okay.
But the abortion pill is truly an abortion pill. It's in addition to being a cortisol receptor blocker, RU486 is also a progesterone receptor blocker. So if after pregnancy is already established, if you block the progesterone receptors, the fetus gets dumped immediately.
Wow.
So yeah, it's a true abortion pill. And they were actually now pushing for this to be available over the counter in most stores in developed countries.
But
So
it
Plan B is
helps.
already available, but now they
Wow.
also want the abortion pill to be also available over the counter.
Wow. I mean, gosh, that just seems like you need to be in the hospital for that. I mean,
Usually, and the really the combination, the if you're getting a medically induced abortion, they give you mifepristone, also a prostaglandin, because the prostaglandin causes contraction of the uterus, and then you basically that fetus that is no longer attached to the uterine wall can get like flushed out, essentially. That's really the standard for inducing medical abortion, but it's
wow.
done in the hospital. But they're saying now, no, we need to make this available to everybody. Maybe one unintended consequence is that
It
the
cures
rates of diabetes
diabetes.
type 2, yeah, is going to drop tremendously, and they're going to regret the decision.
Yeah, because they're those useless eaters are going to be healthy, and
And they're
I
going to, yeah,
got
what are we
that.
going to do there? But back to your question, because progesterone is acts as a cortisol blocker and also reduces the synthesis of cortisol directly. Basically, by taking progesterone, you're usually maintaining a relatively good levels of blood sugar. But if you stop that, right, and at night, if your cortisol is rising, as it does in most people, then I can see that raising your blood sugar, right? Because
Okay.
there's nothing there, or not sufficient. There's nothing there with sufficient anti-cortisol effect to block the effects of elevated cortisol at night. So your
Right.
blood sugar is rising. But look, even those ranges are fake. I'm not sure if you know, but the range for prediabetes used to be 150 back in the 1960s and 70s. Then they lower it to 120. And I think now they're claiming that they're planning on lowering it further down to 100. So it's really just a continued over-medicalization
Like
and
the
pathologization
cholesterol.
of society, yeah, like the
Well,
cholesterol.
but I mean, we want it much, much lower, don't we?
I wouldn't say so unless it's elevated due to a pathological reason. 118 up to 120, in my opinion, is no reason for concern. So just by going for a run on an empty stomach, if you do that and then you go back to your house and you measure your blood sugar, it's probably going to be close to 200 because you're running on an empty stomach. The body needs the sugar to run. I mean, to basically like really, you're running, so obviously you need more energy, right? If you don't supply it, it's going to come from somewhere. And that somewhere will be your tissues, and cortisol will rise to the point that your blood sugar level may reach the 200s. And
Yeah.
that's official diabetes diagnosis. And many doctors don't want to talk about that effect of exercise because then people will start asking questions like, why are you asking me to run three or four times a week? If my
Yeah.
blood sugar is getting to the 200s, is that really good for me? And the
Right.
answer is no. It is
Right.
not. You shouldn't be doing this, but
Interesting.
there's
Well, I
a,
guess it also comes with the symptoms,
yeah.
like the fact that I was super thirsty, and
Super
I
thirsty,
have
yes.
noticed more skin tags, and I heard that skin tags are a, or I read that they are a sign of like
Insulin resistance, yeah, of insulin resistance. But
insulin
that usually
resistance.
means the insulin resistance is usually a sign, not usually, is driven by elevated free fatty acids in the blood, which get elevated by cortisol and adrenaline. So you can take some niacinamide to lower lipolysis, and then you will not have the elevated free fatty acids in the blood.
Right. And then we'll work on liver again. And then this all brings us back to thyroid again. So thyroid, liver, it's just all, you just connect the dots and it all comes back, to
It's all
thyroid
one
and liver
system.
support. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any input to me to in general about pregnenolone with people? Because the
Yes.
reason I wanted to recommend it and the reason I asked our chemist to come up with a product was because so many women do so poorly with progesterone, and I thought this would be a nice, more gentle sort of approach to it. What do you think?
I agree. I would be careful about the dosage. I actually, there's a medical doctor down in North Carolina who follows me on the forum, and he emailed me, so we exchanged a couple of emails. And he wanted to develop a topical pregnenolone. If you want, I'll put you in touch with him.
Okay.
He's trying it on some of his patients, and he was looking for somebody who can provide him with a more reliable supply of a pregnenolone cream.
Okay.
I couldn't do it at the time, but looks like you guys now you have products. So if you want, I will put the two of you in touch. Anyway, he was running experiments with pregnenolone mixed with sunflower lecithin, which is liquid. And he was saying that even tiny amounts topically made him extremely buff, like a bodybuilder, but also gave him like a really bad headache. So he found that for him, the optimal dosage, but I think the absorption may be very high there. The optimal dosage for him was about 10 milligrams per application, even that tiny amount. Yeah. So
Wow.
100 milligrams, I don't know, maybe it may be a bit too much.
Right.
But we can do, I mean, you can do some experiments with him. He tracks his patients, he tests their hormones. So you can find out by working through him what
Yeah.
works best for his patients, and that you may be able to change the formulation based on that if it turns out it's too much.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's something I should look out for. So it's been 5 days and I've just done one pump each. So yeah, it's not available yet, but we have it. So we'll see what happens. Yeah, send me his information. That would
Yeah.
be fantastic.
He's a neurologist. His name is Charles Matthews, and he's a neurologist down in North Carolina. He's basically not treating his patients with high doses of vitamin B1. Basically, he's tried to do the pregnant alone, and he's got some patients with multiple sclerosis and a bunch of autoimmune conditions. I think they did really well in oral pregnant alone, but he wanted to like make a topical product. Was looking for like people who can either supply it or work with him to create it. So now that you guys have it, I think it will be a natural synergy. You can test it on his patients.
Buff, huh? Is he like converting it to
testosterone? Then... yeah, I guess. Yeah, because we were discussing, I have this post that I made on my blog that, because many people are saying, okay, if the rate limiting step to synthesizing all of the steroids is the conversion of pregnenolone, I'm sorry, of cholesterol to pregnenolone, right? So this means that if you accelerate that step, or if you take already preformed pregnenolone, this means you should be getting massive amounts of the downstream hormones. Isn't it not true? I mean, at least that's the theory.
Yeah.
So then basically if you go and read from some of the bodybuilding blogs, forums, they'll say, I tried pregnenolone, even like very high dosages. They don't really do the same thing as the injections of testosterone do for me. It's a non-starter, right? But then there's this study with two people, two males, and they gave them 175 milligrams orally each. And then they were smart enough to basically do the blood testing several times over a period of 24 hours. And you can see that their testosterone, their dihydrotestosterone, their progesterone, their DHEA rose several times, but also after that quickly declined. So it's definitely working as a hormone replacement therapy. But because you're testing blood, chances are that basically that when these hormones are being raised, the cells are absorbing them. So we cannot. So now, actually, I'm working on a project that will kind of confirm that. There's a lab that we use out in Taiwan, and now we're going to give them pregnenolone orally. I don't think this has been done ever with animals or humans. And now, using the testing of hair and nails that my lab in Bulgaria does, we're going to have two groups: a control group and a pregnenolone group. Mm. We're going to give them pregnenolone orally, the one groups, and after a month, we're going to shave the hair before the experiment starts, then at the end, and we're going to see what kind of a change happened inside of the cell. That's really the real test. So we'll know what happens when you take pregnenolone orally, because the experience that this doctor had, and he's in his 70s, he was saying basically very rapid antidepressant effect, and it made him feel like so buff and strong. He almost feel like tackling his son like in a football game. He said like, thank God I didn't do that, because like he's like, I'm 250 pounds, he's 300, and
oh my God,
and it's not fat.
Wow, I wonder if there's some kind of conversion that is the thyroid play a role in once you apply, like once you take it, does it play a role? Because someone was saying, I think it was Constantine was telling me about possibly issues with women who are taking progesterone and having hypothyroid, not just like absorption at the skin, because hypothyroid can make absorption at the skin a little bit more difficult, but is there another part there that the thyroid has to do with when you apply or take progesterone or pregnenolone? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, if thyroid is not functioning properly, I mean the pregnenolone will accumulate, but it will not convert very much, very, very further downstream, because a lot of the enzymes that are required for the conversion downstream, they depend on cofactors that depend on thyroid.
Okay.
Like basically the NAD to the NADH ratio is very important for the conversion of pregnenolone to progesterone. And that ratio is low in hypothyroid people. So, but a study that I saw years ago, which used a chemical very similar to pregnenolone, it's called pregnenolone 16 alpha carbonitrile. So it's essentially the pregnenolone molecule, but in a slight modification at position 16, and it was Hans Selye, the famous endocrinologist out of Canada, that used to work with a lot of pregnenolone. He came up with that pregnenolone synthetic like version, and it was a study with it in rats showing that basically removed the rats' obesity. And the mechanism they propose is that this molecule stimulated the function of thyroid. And I'm thinking that with your cream, if people rub it on their thyroid area, that or progesterone, it may actually be beneficial to further improve the, both the thyroid function and also the conversion of this downstream. Because when you apply it to your thyroid, even in a hypothyroid person, there'll be a decent amount of T3 that's already in the thyroid. So if you give them the pregnenolone as a raw material, the thyroid gland itself, because it possesses all of the necessary machinery and the enzymes for downstream conversion, may be able to convert a lot of this pregnenolone downstream versus if you apply it somewhere remotely, like, I don't know, your feet or your hands or whatnot, only a small portion will reach the thyroid and the rest of it will basically be peripheral and not get metabolized because you're hypothyroid.
Interesting. Wow, that is a good experiment we can do in the group for sure. And so, but then we're kind of, it's, I just have this thing like we're throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks with some of this stuff, because then you've got cortisol to deal with and how you, if you're going to aromatize anything into estrogen later downstream, that's also a possibility, right?
Like, yeah, but with the pregnenolone and progesterone, they're both themselves aromatase inhibitors. So they're kind of controlling, they're going too much down the, see, the body is very tightly regulating the synthesis of cortisol and estrogen because they're such powerful hormones that are not good for you. And basically, if you're taking a precursor, a lot of people are worried that, well, if I take, you know, pregnenolone, it is on the pathway to estrogen. So it's probably going to raise my estrogens a lot. No, recent study that I posted on the forum and the blog showed that pregnenolone can actually inhibit the entry of estrogen into the cell. So if you have a sufficient amount of pregnenolone, regardless of its conversion downstream, if it accumulates in the cell, it's going to prevent estrogen, even if you synthesize a lot of it, from entering the cell. And estrogen that does not enter the cell is largely inactive. Most of the effects that you observe that are dangerous for estrogen or beneficial for the other hormones require entry of that specific steroid inside of the cell. And it looks like the pregnenolone steroids, which such as pregnenolone and progesterone, are capable of blocking the entry of all of the estrane steroids, such as estrone, estradiol, estriol, and their other metabolites. So I don't think it's possible to get a hyperestrogenic effect from pregnenolone or progesterone, even though technically they are precursors and they should be able to convert into estrogen. There's an old French study, which I wasn't able to find anybody to translate it from French into English, that I posted on the forum 3 years ago, showed that pregnenolone in doses of about 500 milligrams, in 250 milligrams orally daily, it was capable of fully blocking the endogenous hyperestrogenicity of a person who had high estrogen naturally, a woman with breast cancer. And then in the dose of 500 milligrams daily, it was capable of blocking the estrogenicity of even potent synthetic estrogens that were given exogenously, such as DES, diethylstilbestrol, which is very potent synthetic estrogen, still used in some countries. Oh, yeah, of course.
Isn't that the one that a lot of women
were given? Yeah, well, and basically
you
caused abortions.
You know Alana Slingsby, right?
Yes.
So I just had her on, and she was talking about her mom being
great. DES.
Yeah.
I don't think the approval has been removed. It's just that people are not using it. But I'm afraid that now that the farm industry is starting to undermine the results of the Women Health Initiative study, the one that can kind of conclusively prove that estrogen should not be given as a supplement, even to menopausal women. Actually, now that we know the results in hair and nail, especially to menopausal women.
Right. Can you send that to me? Do you have that? Can you make a note?
I will send you the published results from the Chinese study. It's a free study. You can open it on any browser.
Okay.
And look at the table. You'll see that the menopausal women had the highest estradiol and the lowest T3. And the lowest progesterone. That basically is the 250 women that they analyzed all the steroids in here.
Yeah.
And also I can send you the links to the description for both the mineral and the steroid analysis that we do.
Yeah.
It's both in hair and nails. So there's some sample reports there that you can take a look at. And basically you'll see what steroids we can test for. And we have some interesting things like, so it's the ratios that really matter as well.
Okay.
And most doctors, they don't talk about the ratios. So we already know about the progesterone to estrogen ratio. Mm-hmm. But there's also the androgens to the estrogen ratio, which is very important for males. There is also the cortisol to the DHEA ratio, which apparently is the most reliable predictor of all-cause mortality ever.
Discovered. Really? Yeah. DHEA to cortisol?
Yes, or cortisol to DHEA. So in other words, you want the cortisol to DHEA ratio to be no higher than 10.
So 10.
In fact, if it's higher than 10, then you're in a chronic stress and basically you're at a risk of anything bad happening to you. So there's also the ratio of allopregnanolone to progesterone, which kind of shows you how well you're converting progesterone to another very potent neurosteroid, which is now approved as an antidepressant in women, the allopregnanolone. So there are a number of different very cool ratios that there's a lot of publications about them, but medicine doesn't has not incorporated them in its testing except for the progesterone estrogen ratio. And even that ratio, I mean, my wife's gynecologist, I've talked to several of them, they don't even know about it. They're saying, oh, this is obsolete stuff. Yeah,
Wow.
my professor in college used to talk about this, and that's
Yeah.
like,
So
so what
what?
changed over the last
Right.
50 years? It's still
Yeah.
there, right? They're still producing
Weird.
estrogen and progesterone.
They don't know how to read it, maybe. I mean, I've sent so many people with their Dutch tests to their doctor's offices, and the doctors are like, nah, it's
What
not
am I gonna, yeah, what
useful.
am I
It's not
supposed to do with
useful.
that? Yeah,
So
exactly.
speaking of the Dutch, so there's a lot of that, the allopregnanolone values and the DHEA to cortisol and all of that stuff on there, but it is urine that excreted. So you are excreting this stuff into your hair and nails. How would it be different, do you think?
Well, because the urine is truly an excretionary mechanism, and it's not cells. You're basically excreting like a liquid, a secretion. And it's usually you're excreting excesses, right? So you can have like, let's say, if you're producing normal amounts of estrogen, but your liver and kidneys are working very well, because estrogen is perceived as a toxin by the liver, you may actually have elevated levels of estradiol glucuronide in your Dutch test. But normal in the blood and normal in the cell. So it's really the ultimate result. The ultimate what you should care about is what's happening in the cell, right? Now, you also care about blood, because if you have elevated levels of estrogen in the blood, but they're normal in the cell, that suggests you have something somewhere producing excess estrogen, usually a tumor. There's no healthy tissue that produces an excess of estrogen. It's not needed. You know, unless you have a wound, right? But that's what cancer is, an unhealing wound.
Why?
So ideally, what you really should be doing is doing blood, cells, and urine, because it captures the entire cycle.
Right.
Think of blood as a surrogate of what's being produced, right? Then think of the cell as basically a surrogate of what's really going on with your body in terms of general health, of the end effects, right? And then think of the Dutch test as basically more or less of a measure of how well your kidney and liver are working, right?
Right.
All of these are valuable things to know, but neither one of them by themselves is really, sort of like definitive, with a possible exception of the hair and nails, because they're telling you what's your intracellular environment right now. That's really the most important thing. But you also want to know how well your liver and kidneys are working, right? You
Yeah.
also want to know if you have something somewhere producing something, ectopic is the medical term, like a tumor, right? Because if you have a tumor, then basically the levels in the blood will be high, but you may have normal levels in the cell, because cells do have mechanisms with which to protect themselves from overaccumulating a specific steroid. So the cells may be sensing that there's an excess in the blood, sort of shutting that door down, right? And saying, I'm not going to accumulate more. But it's a pathology that would not be discoverable on hair and nails, but it will be discoverable on blood tests, right? So the way we advertise this to people is saying, listen, if you want to know the long-term state of your health, because each inch of hair, each half an inch of hair, is basically corresponding to about a month in the past when measured from the base of the scalp. So if you give me a piece of hair that's 6 inches long and it has been cut from the scalp, when we analyze it, we'll basically give you your average levels of any of the hormone that we're analyzing over the last 12 months, right? Okay, so that's the long term, right? Then you can think of blood as the extreme short term, and also showing kind of like how your endocrine organs are working, right? Because the blood is a transport mechanism. If there are low levels in the blood, chances are something's wrong with the endocrine organs, and that's really what we're seeing in menopause. Estrogen and progesterone are both low. Why? Because the ovaries have atrophied and they're no longer producing these two steroids, right? So it is an indication of some kind of a pathology. So that really be my thing. You can start with hair and nails, right? And then if there's an abnormality somewhere in one of these like tests, then you can start digging down further with maybe doing like more specific blood tests, or if it's like if you have a very high levels of estradiol in your cells, chances are you're either hypothyroid, you have breast cancer, or any kind of endocrine cancer producing, estrogen and whatnot. So it can be, kind of sort of like investigated further. So the way I see it is the hair and nails is something you do once, or maybe even at most twice a year, right? Because it's like a long-term averaging. It's kind of like the glycated hemoglobin. When you go to the doctor and gets tested, they test you twice a year, because it shows you the average blood sugar levels over the last 6 months. Well, similar with the hair and nails that we all, because we can look at the last 6 months or even longer. You do it twice a year. You kind of see the direction in which you're going. Are the bad hormones declining and or the good ones rising, right? I mean, that's really what you want to know. If there is an anomaly in the long run, chances are it's still there in the short term, right? Mm-hmm. So you start digging more through blood tests and Dutch tests and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. And then just like correlating it with how you're feeling and what you're dealing with is super important too.
Extremely. Study came out showing that how you feel turns out to be a much better predictor for your long-term health or even survival than the so-called objective biomarkers that the doctors prescribe. I know doctors hate this because they're like, oh, I have this nightmare patient from hell. Basically, they don't know what they're talking about. They keep lying. They don't know how they're feeling. I have these biomarkers. They don't lie, right? But it turns out that if the patient is not feeling well or feels well, turns out that in the long run, it was much more reliable than what the doctor's results were showing.
Right.
So nobody knows better than you
right.
what's going on with you.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I think the tests almost kind of make us a little neurotic sometimes. If you're just like, okay, how am I feeling? What did I tell you? So good. So incredible. I listened to it again when I edited it, and then I'm going to listen to it again and probably again. In the show notes is his information for the hair and nail analysis. I'm going to do it. I decided. I think you should do it. The link is in the show notes. I also have the study that he was talking about, the Chinese study that he was talking about, in the show notes. You can follow him on hydoot.me, which is also in the show notes. He is on Twitter on occasion. And of course, the Repeat Forum. He is very active in that forum. And what else? If you are interested in doing the blood spot lab, I recommend that. If somebody's got some money to spend on their health, I recommend you do all three tests. You do the blood spot lab, you do the hair and nail analysis, and you do the Dutch test. And if you can, get a blood serum. And then that would be amazing. You can bring it all to me. I'll interpret it. You can book a session online and we can look at that entire global picture of you. That would be incredible. I would do that. I would do that, but that's definitely pricey. So the Moment Lab is in the Blood Splot Lab is in the show notes as well. And then, of course, the link to Ona's. We're going to have that pregnenolone very soon here. It might even be out by the time I launch this. It's called Luna Madre. Luna Madre by Ona's, or Luna Madre by Ona's. And it's a pregnenolone product that is 100 milligrams per pump. I recommend using a pea-sized amount once a day. And why did I call it Luna Madre? I'm sure a lot of you know why, because Ona's logo is the moon, and that's Luna in Spanish. And then, of course, Madre means mother, and pregnenolone is the mother of all hormones. All right, friends, talk to you soon.